The warrior Mentat escorted the still-hooded personal attendants out of the room, then swung the heavy doors shut with a sound that echoed throughout the hall. He remained inside, at the door. "So, I see you haven't forgiven me, my son." Helena frowned petulantly. Thufir prowled forward from the tall doors, a weapon in human form. Duncan tensed. "How can you suggest there is something to forgive, Mother, if you maintain there was never any crime?" Leto shifted on his seat. Helena's dark eyes bored into her son's, but she did not respond. Duncan was concerned and perplexed. He barely remembered the wife of the beloved old Duke. She had been a stern and domineering presence when he'd been but a boy who had escaped from the Harkonnens. Pale with suppressed rage, Leto said, "I had hoped you would remain in your nunnery, continuing to feign grief while reflecting on your culpability. I thought I made it clear you are no longer welcome in Castle Caladan." "Eminently clear. But while you remain without an heir, I am the only shred of your bloodline on Caladan." He leaned forward, his gray eyes flashing with fury. "The Atreides dynasty will endure. Have no fear, Mother. My concubine Jessica is even now on Kaitain, soon to give birth to my child. Therefore, you may return to your fortress nunnery. Thufir will be pleased to arrange your passage." "You do not yet know why I have come," she said. "You will hear me out." It was a tone of parental authority that Leto remembered from his childhood, and it stirred old memories about this woman. Confused, Duncan again looked from face to face. He had never been told why Lady Helena had gone away, despite his many questions. Leto sat like a statue. "More excuses? More denials?" "A request. Not for me, but for your distaff bloodline, the family Richese. During the Emperor's heinous attack on Corona, hundreds of Richesians were killed, many thousands blinded. Count Ilban is my father. In the name of humanity, I demand that you offer assistance. With the wealth of our..." Her face reddened. "Your house. You can provide aid and medical supplies." Leto was surprised to hear such a request from her. "I know of the tragedy. Are you asking me to defy the Emperor, who has found Richese guilty of breaking imperial law?" She clenched her black-gloved fist and lifted her chin into the air. "I am suggesting that you help the people who need it most. Is that not the Atreides way, the way of honor? Is that not what Paulus taught you? How dare you lecture me? Or is House Atreides simply to be remembered for acts of aggression, such as the brutal strike against Baikal? Destroy anyone who offends you?" She sneered. "You remind me of the Grumman, Viscount. Is that to be the legacy of House Atreides?" Her words stung, and he leaned back in the stiff wooden chair, trying to cover his discomfort. "As Duke, I do what I must." "Then help, Richese." Further argument was pointless. "I shall consider it." "You will guarantee it," Helena shot back. "Return to the sisters in isolation, Mother." Leto stood from his chair, and Thufir Hawat moved forward. Duncan gripped the old Duke's sword and instinctively closed in on her from the other direction. She recognized his blade and then studied Duncan's face, without knowing who he was. He had changed much from the 9-year-old child she had known before her exile. After a moment of tension, Leto waved them back. "I am surprised you would try to teach me compassion, Mother. However much I loathe you, though, I agree with the need for action. House Atreides will send aid to Richese, but only on condition that you leave here immediately." His expression grew even harder. "And speak to no one of this." "Very well. Not another word, my son." Helena spun about and marched back toward the exit so quickly that Hawat barely got there in time to open the heavy doors. After she and her three shadowy companions flitted through the halls and out into the deepening night, Leto mumbled a farewell, barely above a whisper. Duncan approached the Duke, who sat motionless, stunned. The swordmaster's face was ashen, his eyes wide. "Leto, what was that all about? What is this breach between you two that has never been explained to me? Lady Helena is your mother. People will talk."
"People always talk," Thufir said.
Duncan climbed up the steps to the ducal chair. Leto gripped the carved wooden armrests with white-knuckled hands. His ducal signet ring pushed a dent into the wood. When he finally glanced at his swordmaster, his eyes were murky, like smoke. "House Atreides has many tragedies and many secrets, Duncan. You know how we concealed Kylea's culpibility in the Sky Clipper explosion. You yourself took Swain Guar's place as head of my house guard when we sent him into exile. My people must never know the truth about that, or about my mother." Duncan was not certain where the discussion was leading.
"What truth about her, Leto?"
The Mentat came forward with a warning expression.
"My Duke, it is not wise."
Leto raised a hand. "Thufir, Duncan deserves to know. Because of the accusations cast upon him as a child that he had tampered with the Seleucid bulls, he needs to understand this."
Hawat lowered his head. "If you must, though I advise against it. Secrets do not diminish when they are spread among many ears."
Slowly and painfully, Leto described Lady Helena's involvement in the death of Paulus, how she had arranged for the drugging of the Seleucid bull that had killed the revered old Duke. Duncan gaped without speaking. "I was sorely tempted to order her execution. But she is my mother, despite everything. She is guilty of murder. But I will not be responsible for matricide. Hence, she is to remain with the sisters in isolation until the end of her days." He sank a heavy chin onto his clenched fists. "And Swain Guar said to me on the day I sentenced him to guard her, that I would one day be remembered as Leto the Just." Duncan sat on the step, dropping heavily onto it while holding the revered sword between his knees. Blustery, generous Duke Paulus had accepted the young lad into the Atreides household and given him work in the stables. Then Duncan, a mere child of 9, had been wrongfully accused of involvement by stablemaster Eresk, who was himself implicated in the bullring tragedy. Now the layers of secrecy became clear, the reasoning unfolded, and it felt as if a floodgate had burst open. For the first time in many years, Swordmaster Duncan Idaho wept. Many creatures bear the outward form of a man, but do not be fooled by appearances. Not all such life forms can be considered human. Bene Gesserit, Azhar Book. Since his uncle, the Baron, rarely let him have free rein, Beast Rabban decided to cause as much mayhem as possible, now that he had been given the opportunity. He studied the crude and incomplete maps of settlements around the shield wall. Squalid townfolk lived there, people who survived by scavenging and by stealing Harkonnen property in the middle of the night. In punishment for the Fremen raids on spice stockpiles, the Baron had told his nephew to obliterate 3 such villages. Rabban chose the targets, not quite at random, but because he didn't like their names: Licksand, Thinfair, and Wormsun. Not that it made much difference to him. People all screamed pretty much the same. The first village he simply firebombed from the sky.
With a group of attack thopters, his men swooped low and dropped incendiaries into dwellings, schools, and central markets. Many people died at once, while the remainder ran about like furious insects on a hot rock. One man even had the audacity to shoot up at them with an antique Mala pistol. Rabban's side gunners used the villagers for target practice. The devastation was swift and complete, but Rabban found it ultimately unsatisfying. He decided to take more time with the other towns. Alone in his quarters at the Carthag residency, Rabban had worked long hours before the raids to compose a terse proclamation, explaining why these people must all be killed and their villages destroyed in retaliation for Fremen crimes. Upon showing his handiwork proudly to his uncle, however, the Baron scowled and tore up the note, then wrote a proclamation of his own, using many of the same words and phrases. After each attack, those leaflets, printed on flame-proof Instroy paper, were scattered among the smoldering remains of the obliterated village. Other Fremen would descend like vultures upon the ruins, no doubt trying to pick cheap jewelry from the charred bones. Thus they would learn why the Baron had decreed such brutal punishment. They would feel the blame. For the second village, Thinfair, Rabban marched in with ground troops. They all wore shields and carried hand weapons. A few held back with flame cannons in case they needed to finish the massacre in a hurry. But the Harkonnen troops fell upon the hapless villagers with swords and daggers, slashing right and left. Beast Rabban joined in the slaughter with a broad grin on his face. Back on Gedi Prime, in the giant prison city of Barony, Rabban had often trained children to become victims of the hunt. He had selected the most resourceful and most determined boys to become his special prey during amusing outings at the isolated forest guard station. He didn't necessarily find that murdering children was more satisfying than killing adults, who were often far more creative and more earnest in groveling for their lives. Children didn't have sufficient imagination to comprehend the fate they were about to suffer, and rarely showed enough genuine fear. Also, many children had an innocent faith in God, a naive belief in a protector who would save them. They believed and they prayed up to the last moments of their lives. In the village environment, however, Rabban discovered a new technique with children that gave him more pleasure. It was emotionally satisfying, igniting a warm flame in his heart. He liked to watch the faces of anguished parents as he tortured them, and then slew their own children in front of them. In the third village, Wormsun, Rabban discovered that he could increase his victim's abject terror by distributing the Baron's dire proclamation prior to his attack. That way the captives knew exactly what lay in store for them before the shooting began. At times like these, Beast Rabban was proud to be a Harkonnen. We need no great house status, because we have laid the very foundation of the Imperium. All other power structures must bow to us in order to achieve their goals. Charter of the Spacing Guild Advisory Committee. The guildsman lay retching on a makeshift bed, writhing in pain, his face contorted, poisoned by spice. Four junction specialists stood around the patient, consulting with each other, but none had any idea how to treat him. He thrashed and spat, his face greasy with perspiration. They had placed the seriously ill Highliner coordinator in a sterile room that served more as a medical laboratory than a hospital. High-level guild workers consumed so much melange that they rarely had any need for doctors, and thus their available hospital facilities were minimal. Even if the Spacing Guild had bothered to summon a Sook practitioner, though, the doctor would probably have been incapable of treating any human with a metabolism as distorted as this one's. Questions, but no data, one of the four specialists said. Does anyone understand what happened here? His body reacted to melange, said another man, who had patches of blue hair on his head and bushy eyebrows that nearly covered his eyes. Why would a guildsman suddenly find his daily melange incompatible with his metabolism? That is absurd, said a third. Though they all looked different, the specialists sounded identical, as if a four-part entity were conversing with itself. On the bed, the victim shuddered with a particularly violent convulsion. The specialists paused, then looked at each other. Lights flashed to indicate an incoming file, and a screen on the research room wall lit up with a new summary analysis. One specialist scanned down the information. Verified. The melange itself was tainted. He scrolled down. The spice he consumed is chemically incorrect, and his biochemistry rejected it. How can melange become tainted? Was this an intentional poisoning? The specialists consulted each other, studied more information. Around them lights shone bright and harsh, reflecting off the sterile white walls and making them look like pale ghosts. The four stood at a distance, watching the Highliner coordinator struggle and writhe. He seemed unaware of the presence of anyone in the room with him. Will he live? One asked. Who can say? This may be the second incident, the blue-haired specialist said. We know the navigator aboard the recently lost Highliner suffered from tainted spice gas, too. Interrogation of the passengers is still proceeding. News of the problem is not yet general knowledge in the Imperium. It is the third incident, corrected another specialist. This also explains the crash on Wallach 9. There must be a serious deficiency with melange in the Imperium. But we have found no common source of the problem. This man ate a significant amount of spice that was traced back to a merchant on Baikal. The Prime Magistrate may have been disposing of his illegal hoard because of the Emperor's ultimatums. The two navigators, however, got their spice from different sources, standard guild stockpiles. We have a mystery here. The spice must flow. All melange harvesting and processing is under the Emperor's control. We need to enlist the aid of House Carino. In grim unison, the specialists turned to the broad, filtered window and stared out toward the bleak navigator's field. There, a mechanical crane was erecting a commemorative plaque to honor the two dead guild navigators from the recent Highliner accidents. Another navigator in a sealed tank flew over the field, heading for his departure on a long Highliner run. The meditating navigator hovered over the expanse of nameless plaques and communed with the ancient heart of the Spacing Guild, the Oracle of Infinity. On the hospital bed, the poisoned guildsman screamed so loudly that blood sprayed from his mouth. Convulsions stretched him like a torture victim on a medieval rack. Standing beside his bed, the four specialists heard muscles break, vertebrae snap, and watched him die. We must call Shaddam the Fourth, the specialists said in unison. We have no choice. The manner in which you ask a question betrays your limits. Those answers you will accept, and those you will reject or confuse with misunderstanding. Carbon Fether, The Folly of Imperial Politics. After the lesson of Zanovar, and then Corona, Shaddam the Fourth felt that matters were finally on a proper course. Now, if only he could find a way to cut off the regular flow of spice from Arrakis, he would have the Imperium in the palm of his hand. Master researcher Agitica had sent another glowing report confirming that his Amal had passed all of the rigorous testing protocols. Accompanying the communication was a separate message from Sardaukar commander Kando Garon, the diligent son of the Supreme Bashar, reaffirming everything Agitica had said. The Emperor couldn't have asked for better news. Shaddam wanted the synthetic melange in full production. Now. He saw no further reason to wait. Attired in gray and black Sardaukar jodhpurs and a military shirt with epaulets, he sat back at his extravagant desk and stared at a live hollow of the Landsraad Council, which continued to hold tedious hearings to explore the legalities of the atomic attack he'd made against Richies. Clearly, though, his opposition did not have enough support for censure or a vote of no confidence. Why couldn't they just give it up? Count Fenring had been upset ever since returning from Ix and Junction. But the man had worried too much about the Landsraad members. Shaddam wasn't concerned. Everything seemed to be going very well. In his message, Master Researcher Ajitika had made an odd aside to inquire about the Spice Minister's health. Perhaps Hasimir was feeling too much stress. Maybe he needed to go back to Arrakis. Looking up, Shaddam saw Chamberlain Redondo enter the private study in an uncharacteristic state of agitation and nervousness. Redondo rarely became flustered with any but the most delicate conundrums of court politics.
"Sire, a Spacing Guild emissary insists upon seeing you."
Though annoyed, Shaddam knew he could not turn the emissary away. In matters involving the guild, even an emperor had to tread lightly. Why could he not have arranged an appointment ahead of time? Does the guild not have access to imperial couriers? He snorted to cover his discomfort at the situation.
"I do not know, sire. Nevertheless, the envoy is right behind me."
A tall, albino man with mutton chop sideburns swept into the office. He did not introduce himself or give his rank. The guildsman selected a comfortable suspensor chair. When he sat upon it, he appeared even taller, because of the length of his torso, and gazed down at the emperor. Shaddam withdrew an alaka wood toothpick from a dispenser and casually began to trace the edges of his teeth. The wood had a naturally sweet flavor. "What is your title, sir? Are you the leader of the Spacing Guild, or someone who scrubs exhaust cowlings? Are you the premier, the president, the chief? What do you choose to call yourself? What is your rank?"
"What is the relevance of the question?"
"I am the emperor of a million worlds," Shaddam said, picking rudely at his teeth. "I wish to know whether I am wasting my time with an underling."
"You are not wasting your time, sire."
The guildsman's face, narrow at the forehead and wider at the chin, looked as if it had been pounded into this peculiar shape and drained of all color.
"It is not yet general knowledge, sire, but the guild has recently suffered two major highliner disasters. One crashed onto Wallach 9 with the loss of all passengers and crew."
Shaddam sat up in surprise.
"And was the Bene Gesserit school damaged?"
"No, sire. The Highliner crashed into a very remote area." Shaddam did not hide his disappointment.
"You said there were two accidents?"
"Another Highliner was lost in deep space, but the navigator managed to bring it back to Junction. Our preliminary analysis suggests that both disasters were caused by tainted spice in the navigator tanks."
"Then a third data point. One of our guildsmen consumed a large amount of melange traced to Beakal, which poisoned him. We have confiscated all other remnants of the melange we purchased from Beakal, and it is all similarly tainted. The chemical structure is somewhat peculiar enough to cause these mishaps."
Shaddam threw his toothpick aside. "How would a backwater jungle planet get spoiled spice? Unless they were contaminating it themselves." Then he pounced.
"Beakal isn't supposed to have spice to sell. You found another illegal stockpile? How much?"
"That, sire, is currently under investigation." The guildsman passed an entirely white tongue over colorless lips. "While searching for fiscal anomalies, we discovered that the Prime Magistrate of Beakal has recently spent far more melange than his treasury could possibly own.
He must have a spice hoard.
Shaddam surged with anger, and then anticipation, as he considered another punitive strike. When would the great houses ever learn?
Continue your research, sir, and I shall deal with the Bayekal matter in my own way.
In fact, he was looking forward to it.
This time, however, he planned a different response. He considered discussing the idea with Hasimir Fenring first, but decided instead to let it be a surprise to everyone.
Anirul barely made it to her bed after a pleasant dinner alone with her daughters and Jessica. She had been thinking to herself how much Irulan was blossoming into a beautiful young woman, intelligent and cultured, the perfect princess. And then the universe had gone sour around her. The voices in Anirul's head had returned, and even the sympathetic presence of Lobia within could not hold them at bay.
Anirul collapsed to her knees, dry heaving, and crawled into her bedchamber. Jessica had walked her to the room, and then, in alarm, had summoned medical sister Yosa. Margit Fenring and Mohiam also rushed in to help. After examining Lady Anirul, Yosa quickly gave her a powerful sedative. Only half awake, the Kwisatz mother lay wheezing and perspiring, as if she had run a very long distance.
Yosa looked on, shaking her head. Jessica stood over her, wide-eyed, until Mohiam shooed her out of the room.
"I know her sandworm nightmare has been recurring," Margit Fenring said from the foot of the bed. "Perhaps she thinks she is out in the desert at this very moment."
Mohiam peered with hard eyes at the disturbingly ill woman, who seemed to be fighting sleep, struggling to avoid it. Anirul's eyes alternately opened wide, then grew heavy-lidded.
The medical sister said, "I was not able to reduce the other memory flow soon enough. The gates of Anirul's past lives have been thrown open inside her mind. She may be driven to suicide or to some other form of violence. She could even be a threat to any of us. We must watch her closely."
The fundamental rule of the universe is that there is no neutrality, no pure objectivity, no absolute truth that is divorced from the pragmatic lessons gained in application. Before Ix became a great power in the invention and manufacture of technology, scientists routinely concealed their personal prejudices behind a facade of objectivity and purity of research.
Dominic Vernius, The Secret Workings of Ix.
The prime magistrate of Bayekal had made a mistake, a very serious one. 6 months earlier, Tleilaxu researchers, desperate to obtain Atreides and Vernius genetic samples from an ancient war memorial, had paid a bribe with an outrageously large amount of spice that showed up on no official records. It had seemed a good idea at the time, a boon to Bayekal's economy. After Duke Leto's vengeful attack, the prime magistrate began using that spice to pay Bayekali debts. After passing through several hands, some of it found its way to the Spacing Guild and poisoned a Highliner coordinator, which triggered an investigation that was reported to the Emperor himself. When he sent in his Sardaukar fleet, Shaddam did not comprehend the irony that Bayekal no longer had in its possession the melange they were accused of stockpiling. More ironic still, the prime magistrate never realized that the Tleilaxu had not paid him in genuine melange, but had instead given him a cargo of their unproven synthetic spice. A Highliner dropped off the Imperial fleet at the transfer station of Sansin, a nearby asteroid center and the hub of commerce in the Liabak star system, which included Bayekal and its blue primary sun. Commanded by Supreme Bashar Zoom-Garon, the heavy warships remained at the transfer station. Battle cruisers, monitors, crushers, and troop carriers, all set to proceed toward Bayekal
in a blistering display of power. Shaddam had ordered the Sardaukar to make their intentions obvious first, and to take their time. When the Jungle World's defensive satellite network detected their approach, planetary alarms went off. The Bayakali people panicked. Many took to underground shelters, while others fled into the forest depths. In a futile effort, the Prime Magistrate ordered his private military force to launch warships and form a defensive network in orbit. The ships lifted off, hastily crewed with available personnel. Additional troops scrambled to their planetary garrisons, preparing a second wave of defense. Long-stored weapons were retrieved, uniforms thrown on. "We were caught unawares when Duke Leto Atreides attacked us," the Prime Magistrate said in a public announcement. "We have seen how Emperor Shaddam laid waste to Zanavar and destroyed the Rachesian moon." He sensed the fear of his people. "But we will not stand by meekly and allow ourselves to be slaughtered. Perhaps our world cannot withstand a full Sardaukar assault, but we will make them pay dearly for it." Still stationed at San Sin, the Imperial fleet moved with ominous deliberation. In a typically brief statement, the Supreme Bashar broadcast, "By order of Emperor Shaddam IV, this planet is hereby placed under siege for the crime of stockpiling melange. This blockade will remain in force until such time as your fiefholder confesses to his crimes or proves his innocence." He transmitted no further warning, no ultimatum. The lumbering Sardaukar fleet gave the targeted population more than a day to grow increasingly frightened. During that time, the Prime Magistrate delivered 5 speeches, some of them indignant, others pleading for mercy from the wrath of Shaddam. Behind barricaded doors, the Bayakali leader and his council of ministers met to discuss the problem. A stocky man with a red mustache and a lush, blonde beard, the Prime Magistrate sat in the elevated center cutout of a round conference table, with the ministers arrayed around him. Attired in the dark green toga of his office, he rotated his chair so that he could look at whoever was talking. But most of the time, he just stared off into space. An impending sense of doom hung over him. The ministers wore tight trousers and white tunics with rune symbols on the collars, reflecting their rank and public identity. "But we don't have a melange stockpile. It's all gone," said one minister, a woman with a raspy voice. "We have been accused, but the emperor can't prove we were ever hoarding. What is his evidence?" "What difference does it make?" another said. "He knows what we did. Besides, we should have paid taxes to the emperor. A bribe is still income, you know." The ministers argued around the table, voices high-pitched with emotion. "If House Corino is really after taxes, can't we just figure the value of the melange and offer to pay a large fine? In installments, of course." "But the edicts against spice stockpiling encompass more than tax avoidance. They go to the core of cooperation between the great and minor houses, preventing any house from becoming too independent from the others, too dangerous to the stability of Chom. As soon as the Sardaukar establish a cordon, they will trap us here and starve us out. Our world is not self-sufficient." Smelling the sweat of his fear, the bleary-eyed Prime Magistrate looked at a tracking screen that showed the position of the approaching Imperial fleet. "Sir, 2 big supply ships just arrived at the San Sin transfer station, fully loaded with foodstuffs," reported a minister behind him. "Perhaps we should commandeer them. They belong to a rather obscure House Minor, nothing to worry about. It could be our last chance for a long time." "Do it," the Prime Magistrate said, rising to signify the end of the meeting. "That's something, anyway. Now let's see what we can do to find more good fortune." Just before the arrival of the menacing fleet, Bayakali troops boarded and confiscated the 2 loaded supply ships at the asteroid transfer station, taking them like a pair of fat plums just waiting to be picked. When the Sardaukar forces subsequently went into orbit around Bayakal, They did not engage the local defense forces. Instead, the Supreme Bashar instructed his ships to maintain their distance as ominous guardians that would refuse to grant any vessel access to Baikal or to the nearby asteroids. A man of emotional ups and downs, the Prime Magistrate was energized by the success of the operation. "We can wait them out," he declared in yet another speech, this one on an outdoor acoustic stage. In his usual green toga, he had shaved his beard as a symbol of austerity. "We have supplies, we have workers, and we have our own resources. We have been falsely accused." The gathered crowd cheered, but with an undertone of extreme anxiety. "The Emperor will be long in his tomb before we surrender." The Bayakali leader raised a fist in the air, and his people clapped in support. Overhead, the Sardaukar forces settled in to wait, a noose tightening around the planetary equator. Error, accident, and chaos are persistent principles of the universe. Imperial Historical Annals. "We haven't played shield ball in years, Hasimir," Shaddam said as he leaned over the device, pleased that his score was 1 point higher than Fenring's. They were in the Emperor's private quarters, on the top level of the Imperial Palace. Distracted, the Count moved away from the gaming table and went to the balcony. In years past, he and Shaddam had developed numerous schemes together, many of them plotted during shield ball competitions, such as the original idea for creating a spice substitute. Now, knowing the treachery of the Tleilaxu master researcher and his murderous face dancer, Fenring regretted the entire plot. The Highliner tests, too, seemed a total disaster. But the Emperor wanted to hear none of it. "You're imagining things," he said. "I have received a report from the Guild itself, and they have discovered tainted spice originating from an illegal stockpile on Baikal. They are convinced this insidious poisoning is the cause of the recent accidents, not your Amal." "But we cannot be sure, sire. The Guild will not release the designations of the lost Highliners. I find it suspicious that two large vessels experienced traumatic mishaps after I..." "What connection could there possibly be between Baikal and Ejitika's Amal research?" He sounded exasperated. "None!" The master researcher's glowing reports, along with the repeated reassurances of Commander Kando Garon, had him completely convinced about the impending availability of synthetic spice. "Have you, personally, in all your inspections of the Tleilaxu work, ever seen specific evidence that the Amal does not work as Ejitika claims?" "Not as such, sire." "Then stop looking for excuses, Hasimir, and let me play." The game mechanism buzzed, and the Emperor withdrew a guiding rod. The hard ball bounced and crackled through the elaborate labyrinth of components. Shaddam scored again and laughed. "There! I challenge you to beat that!" Fenring's eyes flashed. "You've been practicing, Shaddam, Not enough imperial matters to occupy you?" "Now, Hasimir, don't be a sore loser."
"I haven't lost yet, sire."
Overhead, the night skies of Kaitane shimmered with pastel auroras. The Padishah Emperor had recently ordered a launch of satellites containing rare gases that were ionized by particles from the solar wind, enhancing the colors that rippled across the constellations. He liked to light up the sky. Fenring returned to the shield ball device. "I am pleased that you chose not to crush Baikal like Zanovar. A siege is much more appropriate, since the evidence was not exactly compelling enough for a more emphatic response. In all likelihood, Baikal has already spent their hoard on other things." "The evidence is sufficient, especially when you consider the contamination that likely caused the Highliner accidents." Shaddam gestured toward the game device, but Fenring still did not take his turn. Just because they've spent their entire illegal stockpile doesn't mean they didn't flout imperial restrictions in the first place.
But if you retrieve no large reward of melange, you can't bribe Choam and the guild to support your policies. Not a good investment of violence,
Mao Shaddam smiled. Now you see why I've had to be much more subtle in this case.
Fenring's eyes widened in concern, but he refrained from commenting on Shaddam's skill at subtlety.
How long is this blockade going to go on? You've made your point, scared them down to their bones. What more do you need?
Ah, Hasimir, watch and learn.
Shaddam paced around the table like an excited little boy. Soon it will become obvious that the blockade is imperative. I am not doing this simply to prevent House Bayekal from obtaining outside supplies. No, there's much more to it. I won't destroy their world. I'll let them do it themselves.
Fenring grew more alarmed.
Perhaps you should have consulted me before setting your plans in motion, sire.
I can make magnificent plans of my own without your help.
Though Fenring disagreed with that assessment, he decided not to argue. Pensively, he turned to the game, dropped another ball into play, manipulated the rods with deft fingers, and intentionally achieved a low score. Now was not the time to demonstrate his superior abilities to the Emperor. With mounting excitement, Shaddam continued.
You see, when my Sardaukar informed Bayekal of the imminent siege, the Prime Magistrate sent ships scrambling to Sandsind in order to stockpile foodstuffs. Like a pirate, he commandeered 2 fully loaded supply ships that were just waiting there, as I knew he would.
Yes, yes. Fenring tapped his fingers on the table, surprised that Shaddam didn't jump back to the game and take his own turn.
And your ships stood by and let him gather sufficient cargo to last Bayekal for perhaps 6 months. A rather inept way to administer a siege,
He fell into my trap, Shaddam said. The Prime Magistrate will begin to realize the real plan soon enough.
Ah, yes, quite soon.
Fenring sat back, waiting.
Unfortunately, the 2 supply ships he stole were loaded with contaminated grains and dehydrates. Tit for tat, considering what they did to the spice they sold to the guild.
Fenring blinked.
Contaminated with what?
Why, with a terrible biological agent that I just happened to be sending for study under controlled conditions to a distant planet. For security reasons, the plague-infested supplies were unmarked and placed in nondescript vessels so they could be transported without causing alarm.
Fenring's skin crawled. But Shaddam fairly gushed with pride at his cleverness.
Now that the Prime Magistrate has stolen this cargo and taken it to Bayekal, he has brought with him a biological agent that will defoliate the jungle belt. Crops will wither and die. Forests will fall into skeletons. Within days we will begin to see the effects.
Such a tragedy.
Fenring had thought the use of atomics on Corona and the unexpected blinding of so many Rachesians already went far beyond the pale. Even by his standards, it was all too much. An entire planetary ecosystem.
I don't suppose this decision can be reversed,